I'm delighted to welcome you to the first Advanced Engineering Talks podcast of 2023. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jeremy Whittingham from the UK Advanced Engineering event. This, in fact, is the first of a new series of podcasts hosted by Advanced Engineering, which, as you may know, is the UK's largest annual engineering and manufacturing technology event, held every November at the NEC in Birmingham. It's this year on the 1st and 2nd of November, a two-day show. But innovation never sleeps, and we don't just wait until the show dates before we talk about it. As thought leaders, we're always ready to bring together the disruptors and brightest minds to discuss the critical issues and challenges of the industry and their importance to humanity in general. So I'm delighted to introduce the topic of today's podcast, which is looking at the goals and challenges of space and the space economy, particularly from a UK point of view, and also in terms of what may be some vital and even controversial elements of a space sector, such as sustainability, investment, and the public perception. We'll be talking to our main guest and interviewee, Melissa Thorpe, head of Spaceport Cornwall. But before that, I'm delighted to introduce Gary Cannon, who is space sector lead at the UK's Satellite Applications Catapult. Welcome, Gary, and thanks for joining me.
Okay, so first of all, my reason for loving the idea of joining this podcast is because my raison d'etre throughout pretty much my entire career has been to do the best I can for the UK space economy ever since my early days at Airbus, and then particularly back at Surrey Satellites, because they were real pioneers and trailblazers in the small satellite market. Right. And some of the stuff they were doing and talking about, I remember talking to some colleagues about spaceports back in, God, this would have been like 2005, 2006. And I remember laughing at them, thinking, what are you talking about? A spaceport in the UK? You know, there's Cape Canaveral. That's it, right? Maybe Vandenberg. But I remember. But this chap, what was his name? Paul Geish, a friend of mine from Barcelona. He was working at Surrey. And he started working with Andy Bradford, a very senior figure within the space industry, about the possibility and feasibility of spaceports in the UK. And obviously one thing has led to another. And we now have, obviously, Melissa and Spaceport Cornwall with the first UK launch. That's been absolutely amazing for UK launch. But we do, of course, have, is it six or seven other facilities around the UK that are looking at both horizontal and vertical launches? So it's a great place to be. And there's so many launch vehicle companies, or companies creating launch capability, that it just proves the fact that this is a massive industry, and also to your point about it's a growing industry as well, like the what we call the cislunar economy, like the between Earth and the moon. There's going to be an economy in its own right, and that's going to require all sorts of capability, from orbital transfer vehicles, in-orbit manufacturing for materials, and semiconductors and pharmaceuticals, and then building things in space, like assembly in space clusters and formation flying and massive superstructures in space. And of course, this is all backed up as well with SpaceX's Starship, lifting hundreds of tons into space. This doesn't happen because, there's 40,000 people think it might be a good idea. There's an absolute industry here. And going to your point about net zero, a lot of the launchers, the launch vehicle companies, they're very aware of the fact that they have to create clean plumes, basically. So a lot of the fuels that they're using are green as well.
That's amazing. Melissa, I'd love to bring you in here. Introduce you again. Thanks so much for joining us and taking the time to be part of this. You are head of Spaceport Cornwall. It's been a bit of a roller coaster in the last few months as well for you over there. But ups and downs are part of being, the pioneers,
that you are, it's been a few weeks now since the launch, and I was just also interested to find out how you're feeling now in terms of what's next for you in terms of your priorities at this stage.
Yeah, really positive.
Good.
Well,
yeah.
Obviously, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been quite a journey, to say the least. I came into the kind of the spaceport world a few years after Gary first kind of heard about it. Probably first back in 2013, 2014 is when we first started to investigate the potential for Spaceport Cornwall, and it quite quickly started to pick up momentum. But you know, to spend 9 years, almost a decade of your life, passionately working towards kind of creating that access to space for the UK for the first time ever on UK soil has been, you know, ups and downs. It's been a roller coaster ride.
Yes.
Definitely. You know, starting with the point that kind of Gary was saying with disbelief and people kind of making fun of the whole thing, to then, you know, a month ago, we made history. We got a rocket to space, and obviously, unfortunately, the payloads didn't get to their orbit, which was hugely disappointing to everybody involved, because as Gary said, you know, this industry is so passionate about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and and at the end of the day, it's humans and individuals that make it happen, and it really is their life's work. And so to see that kind of the other side of this industry, and you know, we mentioned a few names at the beginning, but you know, I'm so lucky to have somebody like John Paffett on my wing, because he brings all this decades of expertise in the space industry, but also kind of understands that launch doesn't always go to plan, and sometimes you know, that risk of not getting what you've worked so hard on to where it needs to be. He's felt that before. So to have those kind of people around me was really important, because it was my first one.
Right.
And you know, so it hurt big time. But I also then had all these people around saying, no, come on, this is part of it. This is part of what this industry is all about.
Yeah.
You're going to learn so much, and you're just going to go and do it better next time. So
that's
what the last month has definitely been. And now the team, we're just, you know, really, really excited for the second launch and all the bits in between now, because we know what it's like, and we also know how we've learned so much. So just implementing that now for launch two.
Yeah. And what's the sort of timeline plan for launch two at the moment?
Well, luckily enough, we're a licensed spaceport, so from our perspective, we could do it again very quickly. So now we're just totally supporting Virgin Orbit in what they need to do to get back here. They have their launch out of Mojave planned for this spring. So I think they're already looking at integration in the next few weeks. So they're quite quickly moving forward. Obviously, their full investigation is still ongoing, but from what Dan Hart said, the CEO, a couple of days ago at a conference, was they're pretty sure they've narrowed it down to just a simple filter that dislodged. So now that we know that it's not a fundamental design issue or anything like that, they're moving quickly forward with that next launch out of Mojave, and then we'll get we're aiming for a Rocket 9 to come out of Cornwall later this year.
Right That's good to know that you've quite quickly pinpointed what the issue might have been there then, and it sounds as if it's not too terrible in that respect to holding things up.
On that note, like, obviously the whole point of rocket engineering is called, you know, rocket science for a reason. This is this is hard stuff, isn't it? What we're trying to do.
Yes.
We're essentially strapping.
You almost
strapping.
Have to fail, don't you, to go through to these things. Sometimes to learn from it.
That's an interesting point as well. If we could come back to that one, Jeremy, because
but fail early sometimes.
Testing lots and failing early and learning more as well. Yeah. But because that's not a very what I call old space approach. Old space is, you know, you design the hell out of something and you keep designing it until you're absolutely sure that it's going to work and it's not going to break in space. And the UK's got a great reputation for doing that. We're so good generally at a lot of this bespoke engineering, and Astrium is now Airbus Defence and Space. You know, their satellites they've got such a great record, and this everybody else that has like filled in the gaps in the market, you know, as you move down from the huge like 8-ton spacecraft that Airbus do, down to the 5 kilogram spacecraft. The record in the UK is really good. But with rocket launch, you are essentially strapping, you know, highly sensitive bits of instruments to a bomb. You know, it's a rocket launch is a controlled explosion. And the amount of power that goes through a rocket and all of that engineering and the sciences that goes into everything from the instruments through to the rocket is trying to get that all to work together is hard stuff, you know, and oh. As Melissa will testify, there's a great phrase in the industry, space is hard. So, yeah, and that's been my experience, what you were talking about before, Melissa, about there's great sadness when something like the recent launch failure, when that happens. But the positivity in the industry is great. Everybody like dust themselves off, and we're a great bunch. You know, there's what, 45,000 people in the space sector in the UK. They're all so positive. They learn well. You know, it's great to I've worked with so many of them, and they're such a positive bunch, and they will learn from this, figure out how we do it better next time and faster and, you know, more economically, and yeah, we'll definitely get there. And just to think about it's not just Spaceport Cornwall. The Shetland spaceport alongside Lockheed Martin, is it the RB-1 rocket? That's they're laying concrete for their launch pads.
Saxford, yeah. And we also have the Highlands and Islands in Sutherland with Orbex as well. So we work really closely with all the other sites. It's for us, it's about securing launch for the UK going forward. And, you know, it's that UK launch proposition, and we work together on that. So for us, it's just the fact that we had a bit of a head start, and the fact that we're, you know, repurposing an airport, which makes life a little bit easier. Not that it's easy at all, but from a licensing perspective, and we had obviously a system that was tried and tested over in the US for quite a few launches. So for us, we kind of had a little bit of a head start. But yeah, you know, sharing best practice with our friends up in Scotland has been really important to us as well.
Right. And this is a bit of an open question to both of you from my point of view, because I'm not, you know, as specifically in the industry as each of you are, I mean, just a question of how do you think sustainability in space would translate to sustainability on Earth, or just what we're doing in space would benefit Earth in some examples. I think in orbit manufacturing was one of the things I think you mentioned as an example, Gary, but there's probably quite a few things, including perhaps even cleaning up space itself with all that junk up there. What do you think would be maybe the fastest growing part of all that?
Active debris removal is probably one of the biggest elements of that. I think it was around about the 2010 timeframe, the European Space Agency created a mandate that all spacecraft had to remove themselves from their orbital slot within 25 years. And this was at the time when passive degradation of the orbit for low Earth orbit was considered okay. So this is all the like LEO orbit, low Earth orbit, altitudes from like 400 to is around about the 600, 700 kilometers in altitude. Those spacecraft could passively deorbit. But of course, that created an industry in more capability for deorbit, like drag sails like electrostatic deorbiting. And then, of course, with the increase or improvement in electric propulsion capability, that allowed smaller, lighter, more energy efficient propulsion systems to be put on spacecraft so that they could deorbit faster and basically get out of the way of other spacecraft. And then, of course, geostationary spacecraft, they go out to a what we call a graveyard orbit. They burn the last remnants of their fuel to go out to an orbit where they they're just out of the way of those orbital slots. So there's a lot of sustainability, I suppose, within the space industry itself. But of course, so much of our in space assets deal with sustainability on Earth. And indeed, I'll just drop this in here, the catapult's actually running a program called Now, I'm going to have to remember the acronym. It's the Economic Development of Space for the Sustainable Development of Earth, because there's so much that you can get from space assets in climate change and monitoring net zero and all that lot. There's a lot that space can do for sustainable activity, or like human activity on Earth. In fact, just a little anecdote. I remember when COVID hit and the Sentinel, the European Space Agency's Sentinel spacecraft, were showing, publicising pictures of the greenhouse gases over the Earth, basically. And I remember this particular image I have was of China, and it showed the greenhouse gas concentration almost disappear within the first few months of the lockdowns, because of course all the factories shut down, and you could see it was almost like the Earth recovering from human activity briefly. Yeah. And some reports have also said the Earth actually started to cool down a little bit as well. I heard reports of half a degree cooling during the pandemic. And again, all monitored by our assets in space.
Wow. Right. That really shows the proof that humankind is behind a lot of what's going on.
It really does.
It correlates with the pandemic as well. Do any of those skeptics out there, if they still exist in pockets? Melissa, from your point of view, you're doing a lot, to try and reach net zero in terms of what you're doing in terms of operation of the spaceport. What sort of things might that involve?
Yeah, I mean, everything that Gary just said is amazing. And, you go to these conferences and I'm just continuously blown away about, all the amazing applications of satellites in space to help us here back on planet Earth, whether that's the, monitoring Earth observation and making heavy polluting industries more efficient, like things like GPS, but also monitoring what the baddies are up to unbiasedly, showing that is crucial. Issue I've always had with it, and the irony I would say, I guess, in the industry, is that we launch all these amazing satellites to space, but the way that they're getting there is impacting our environment. So we're going on to help the environment, of course we are, but up until very recently, it hasn't really been on the top of any spaceport or launch operators' agendas to be more sustainable. It's a more of a recent thing, definitely. So how do we get these incredible technologies to space, but in a more efficient, sustainable, ethical way? And, a lot of our UK satellites are shipped overseas to launch. There's a impact there on the shipping, but also some of the places up until very recently that they were going to, trying to find out anything about how they're launched, how people that work in that area are treated. Do they have outreach programs? It's been very difficult to get that level of transparency, I would say, in this industry, especially the launch industry. That's what we're trying to fundamentally change is, how can we create a spaceport that considers what our impact is transparent about that impact. And I mean the entire impact, not just the emissions from a single rocket launch, but the whole life cycle across the build and shipping and transport and, the impact on the upper atmosphere as well, which is a complete new area of kind of research that's looking as things transfer through the atmosphere, as well as come back down in the debris kind of world. So starting to look at that whole picture, and then only then can we decide where our time and effort and resource should be spent on the biggest areas of impact. So for us, we've done that kind of initial assessment, and our biggest areas are the transport of the 747 over here. So just basic aviation fuel, things like what happens when the first stage drops in the sea. I think there's an area here with launch that's kind of been maybe a blind eye has been turned to it. But for the last 50 years, all rocket launches, pretty much there's been pieces that have ended up in the sea. And do these pieces create artificial reefs? Do they break up and become more pollution in our seas? We don't really know. There's, again, another kind of lack of research in this area. There's bits and pieces out there. So we're starting to commission quite big research opportunities with people like National Geographic, University of Exeter, University of Plymouth, to start to look at our rocket launches in the future. You know, what are the first stages doing? What's happening when they sink? Because they do sink quite quickly. And then we can start to look at what we do to mitigate against that. I think up until now, again, rocket launches, it's actually, when you look at it, their global impact is quite low for carbon emissions, considering what they go on to do. It is really low, but what if we can do it, you get that even lower? I think that's where we're kind of, you know, really trying to change, and then go out and start to kind of challenge the rest of the industry to do the same.
Yeah. That's an interesting point you raise about the stages there, Melissa, because of course something we're looking at in the Catapult, and again across the global industry here, is reusability and recycling of materials in space. So when a satellite comes to the end of its life, rather than deorbiting and letting it burn up in the atmosphere or go out to a graveyard where it's you know, useless and can't be used again, there's a lot of talk of can we extract some of those precious metals from the spacecraft. And there are companies looking at extraction of metals and then extrusion of those into reusable forms. And indeed, before you even start to break the metals down, can we use, it's not all components that break on a spacecraft, they don't all come to the end of their life at once. Some of those components will be perfectly usable. There's a bit of a movement to look at how we can design spacecraft so that they can be serviced or taken apart and new parts or new assemblies put into them. It feeds into the sustainability piece. I'm not sure about stages myself. So yeah, as Melissa was saying, a lot of these stages all come back to Earth. There are, of course, some still orbiting, which are causing a bit of a problem. And these are the targets for active debris missions.
I heard a percentage. I may have this slightly wrong. Is it 40% or quite a significant percent of satellites that are launched kind of break down up there? And again, that's not very sustainable if they're failing so easily. And one wonders if there should be more rigorous testing before these satellites go up in some cases. I don't know if that's an issue. It's an issue I've heard talk of, but it's still quite, you know, relatively easy to put small satellites up there. Is that an issue or not?
Are you talking about reliability of spacecraft?
Yes, I suppose so. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And somebody, I did hear there was quite a large percentage. This is just generally around the world, I think, of organisations or people putting them up there now. That you know, a lot of them fail quite easily and become space junk quite quickly. And you kind of wonder, well, should there be a certification? Surely there must be, but perhaps you know more about that than I do. But I don't know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, indeed, I haven't heard the 40% myself. But of course, there are a lot of people. If you're spending the money to put a spacecraft in space, you kind of want it to work because it's usually the spacecraft is part of a business case. You will have a business model. You want to get data from, you know, data about greenhouse gas concentration in a particular area. To do that, you need a spacecraft. So you invest, you know, a few million to get a greenhouse gas observing spacecraft into space. And if it doesn't work, then, you know, you're in trouble. You might have insurance and the like, but you'll be behind the curve now. You'll be a few years down the line by the time you've built another one and got that up into space. Right. So, I'm not familiar with the 40%, but I do know that obviously a lot of them, they do burn up, like I say, in space.
Right.
As this is, you know, after their lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. Melissa, I was wondering, obviously, you know, the launch that you've been and the launches that appear to have been concentrated on, you know, are about satellites and putting them up there. But in terms of the longer term future or even the nearer term, would there be other uses that you'd be involved in as a launch capability? For instance, you know, ultimately in orbit manufacturing, you know, outside there, would that be a possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, we got to crack satellite launch first, which is hard enough, which I'm focusing on. But yeah, I mean, we've already started to explore what's next in the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And, you know, I'm so excited by it. And the first step was getting this launch capability and the license and starting to prove that capability. So we're in those stages now. Obviously, on the first launch, we had Forge Star Zero, so Space Forge, who are looking at, obviously, in orbit manufacturing and reusability of satellites as well in the future. So our partnership with the team there, who are amazing, we kind of go way back with them, is something that we want to continue to support and help them grow in Cardiff as well as the UK and globally. It's, you know, amazing what they're up to. For us, we're looking at we've signed an MOU with Sierra Space as a return landing site for Dream Chaser, and that will be quite interesting for us because it shows when we might have a crewed spacecraft coming back from space with experiments, microgravity, products, cargo on board, how we handle that when it lands. And we've already started to create our new facilities and tried to future-proof them to be able to handle some of those microgravity experiments. We're, you know, really keen on looking at human spaceflight for research purposes and developing that capability in the UK. One thing that we've been talking about more and more with some of our friends over in the US is point-to-point travel and how we look at maybe feasibility and case studies between the two, initially with cargo and maybe with humans in the future as well. You know, we're exploring it all. We're seeing, for us, it's got to work with our kind of day-to-day operations. The beauty of our site is that we're integrating with a civilian airport. And that's the reason we've been able to create a space for not a lot of money or a lot of changes infrastructure wise. Right. And we want to keep that integration piece, you know, at the core of what we do, so that you have, you know, people taking off on their passenger flights to Alicante, for instance, and, you know, this is what was happening a couple of weeks ago, and they look out the window and they'd see Cosmic Girl with the rocket ready to go to space. So that is really important to us, that we keep all the activities happening at the airport. It's multi-user, there's lots going on, and create that kind of clustering effect around the launch itself. So we don't ever imagine that we're going to be everything, and that the sites in Scotland will be able to pick up some things that we just will never do or never want to do out of our location. The connectivity, the airspace, all that from Cornwall is really crucial for the economy down here. So it will have to kind of fit with the overall kind of business at the site, which makes our site unique in that it's not all eggs in one basket. It's not all about launch. So the business strategy of our spaceport is diverse across loads of other things on site that's happening. And this is just kind of one business unit of the site, which, when you look at spaceports, and I'm about to head over to Florida for this Global Spaceport Alliance, and I think there's, you know, 70 something spaceports that will be there. For me, the sustainability from an economic perspective is so important, because a lot of public will, taxpayer money, tends to go into these types of projects, and it's got to make sense. At the minute, the cadence isn't quite there for all of them to work. So what else are you doing if you're waiting for launches, you know, between those launches? And that's been, you know, again, at the center of our spaceport.
Something you just reminded me of there, Melissa, was the regulation piece, and it goes back to the question you had before, Jeremy, about what's the word, like, responsible use of space. Of course, they are, all spacecraft are regulated through the Civil Aviation Authority, that's in line with the Space Industries Act 2018. So they monitor, they understand that, and they understand how spacecraft is supposed to behave, and spacecraft operators have to prove to the CAA that the spacecraft is going to work. So when you talk about, you know, launching spacecraft and not sure if they're going to work, that wouldn't get a license in the UK. So the UK is absolutely trailblazing on sustainability of in space. And the same goes for the rocket launches as well. And I just wanted to ask Melissa about your experiences with the CAA, because you guys had to go through a lot of regulation to get the spaceport license and the ability to launch a rocket from the UK. What was your experience like?
It was hard. thousands of pages of written documents, because we had the spaceport license, the operator license that Virgin Orbit had to get. We had then the airspace, the range license, and then we had every satellite had to be licensed. So that's a huge licensing regime to go through, and we were the first to do it. So everybody was learning. We got through, I think ours was approved in something like 13 months and Virgin's was approved in about 15. So it was within the timeframes that they set out. We definitely learned a lot. We'll be doing some tweaks for the next one. But I think for our first time, that's pretty good. And I think it's something that we can be massively proud of in the UK, our regulatory environment, which seems in some, and I've heard there's a lot of criticism out there about it, because it's quite a layer of bureaucracy on top of something that's trying to be commercial. When you're up against places that have been launching for 50 years, and whether you're a satellite manufacturer or a launch operator or a spaceport, that competition is quite hard to break into, even without layers of regulation. So I think there's got to be some changes to make us more competitive going forward. But I think in these first few years, it's really important to lay the foundations and the groundwork, and I guess the global kind of benchmark in more responsible launch. And I think there's a niche area now going forward that the UK can really capitalize on is, look, if you want an ethical, responsible place to launch, you know, here we are. This is a really good, and like Gary was saying, every satellite has to be licensed, tested and licensed. So we know the quality of what's going to come out of the UK is really high. Right. And I think from a sustainability point of view, we had to do an assessment of environmental effects, both ourselves and Virgin, which included a marine license. So where the stage was dropping, that had to go out to public consultation. I mean, this is huge levels of kind of legislation and regulation. But we took that assessment of environmental effects one step further, and we opened it up to the whole life cycle analysis. And again, it's just something that we're proud of, because we didn't make it easy on ourselves, but on purpose, so that now we have this really solid foundation that we can kind of build off of and make more efficient going forward. It'll be interesting to see how the regulator adapts and changes over the next few years as we learn more from each one. And we have loads of wash-up sessions. They've been really supportive and engaging with us. And we kind of all had to just come at it together as a bit of a team effort, because it's the first time and we were the guinea pigs. We're all still friends. And I think that's a good thing at the end of the day.
Right. That's good to know.
You raise a good point there, Melissa, on the whole ESG point. It was economic, social and governance markers and finance for launch and spacecraft. Because, of course, whilst it's hard to, develop the regulation and the legislation for launch and operating rockets and spacecraft, with the CAA developing these regulations, and they've learned so much. I know we've got a good relationship with those guys, and they've got a great team over there, a big team of people that have worked in the space industry and the aviation industry. So that team is really working together well. But yes, they've been learning this whole way. And one of the benefits of having this regulation or this level of regulation from the UK is around this ESG point, because if you as a company can prove that you are being sustainable and you're looking after your social and governance kind of responsibilities, then you're more likely to get finance for some of the projects you're taking on, because the people investing have to ensure that they're what they're investing in is sustainable as well. because of the whole ESG thing. And I know Joanne Wheeler, she's a legal star in the space industry. She's looking at with a group of people setting up this kite mark for space equipment, be that launchers or launch capability spacecraft. And that kite mark is essentially going to be something along the lines of, this product has been certified to be good from an economic, social and governance point of view, and therefore we are a good sustainable company. And when investors can see that kite mark, they can see the fact that they're taking their sustainability credentials seriously. That attracts more investment into the market, and again that starts to kickstart more a growth in the space market in the UK, because that's something that we are a little bit behind on. Really, the financial mechanisms. The US has got some great financial mechanisms for developing space capability, and the UK is looking at this. I know that there's some good people. Again, we've got a team of people at the Catapult here looking at finance mechanisms for the UK space industry. This ESG markers and this kite mark is going to form part of the improvement in investment in the space industry in the UK.
Well, thank you, Melissa and Gary. Some really good conversations there. You'll be listening to this now probably via the Advanced Engineering website. So please do contact us with any thoughts or insights or things that this has brought up for you, or whether you have some ideas or would like to join us on one of our podcasts going forward. Thanks, of course, so much to our guests. Melissa Thorpe, Head of Spaceport Cornwall, and to my fantastic co-host, Gary Cannon, thank you, at the Satellite Applications Catapult. We'll be in touch with the next podcast information soon, but stay tuned also on our website. And as I say, we welcome interaction, so please contact us with any thoughts or ideas. We look forward to hearing from you. Take care. Goodbye.